Okay, so I wanted to say, first off, if anybody has any questions during your talk, just please shout it out. Interrupt me at any point if you have a question. So what I'll talk about today is some work that was done with my postdoc, Ornan Meng, a collaborator, Michael Brenner, who's an applied mathematician, his student, Natalie Arcus, and then my grad student, Jesse Collins, also funded by NSF. I first just want to explain what the title means, self-assembly. What I mean by self-assembly is any process in which you can take a bunch of things in a fluid, right? So a bunch of things in a fluid, particles, molecules, polymers, whatsoever, and they'll come together and spontaneously form an ordered structure. There's lots of examples of this. Crystallization is sort of a simple example of this. In biology, there are many examples which I'll talk about. I want to define that term first because there's a lot of talk in certain physics circles about a more general phenomenon which I would call self-organization, right? Self-assembly is a sort of subset of what I would call self-organization. What drives these things to assemble, what causes them to move around, is just thermal fluctuations in the system. Okay? So these are systems that are, say, room temperature. There are things that are dissolved in a fluid that come together to form these ordered structures. Self-organization is something a bit broader than this, where the driving force can be all sorts of things, different kinds of forces that you can drive it with. So I'm in a much more limited thing, but nonetheless, there are interesting things that happen. So as Lucia mentioned, I'm both an engineer and a physicist. I will explain a bit of the engineering question here. Why are people interested in this whole idea of self-assembly? For engineers, this would be a really neat way to actually make things. So here's a dream that what you could do, instead of making things the way we do now, which is, say, if you wanted to make a car, right, you can have to machine all the parts. And to machine all the parts, you sort of take a big block of stuff and you chop it down into whatever you want it to be, right? Self-assembly is sort of another idea, which is, well, what if you did this by growing what you want instead of chopping it down? So the dream is you can synthesize some building blocks with some specific interactions between them, let them assemble to form what you want, and then make a material out of it. And to sort of put this in context, let's give you an example. Wouldn't it be great if I could go to a lab right now, and I have a wet chemistry lab, and synthesize some molecules, polymers, particles, whatsoever, have a big soup of stuff. And wouldn't it be great if I could just take this, let it sit on the counter for a while, and have it spontaneously form, say, the latest generation Intel microchip? Wouldn't it be great if we could actually do this? Well, it seems like a crazy idea, and we're certainly very far off from it now. But in fact, it's not something that's, I would say, physically impossible. The reason we know this is because things like this, where things come together spontaneously and form fascinating functional devices, this happens all the time in biology. And so if you ask a biologist about self-assembly, they'll basically yawn. And say, oh, what's the big deal? This is an example of a self-assembled functional structure that happens in biology. And this is called a Claflin cage, okay? 70 nanometers across. This thing is designed to protect some cargo. Right? And it spontaneously self-assembles. It's happening in your body all the time, the self-assembly process. Comes together to protect some cargo, and it's used to transport that cargo in between cells or within a cell. It's a transport mechanism. And I just want to show the structure of this thing. This thing starts as just some soup of amino acids. Those amino acids then get polymerized together actively by some machinery of the cell. Okay? And then they form a long chain of amino acids called the protein. Right? But then once that chain forms, it starts to organize. Okay? And the first thing it does is it assembles into these helices. Right? The chain assembles into these helices. And this is called the secondary structure. But then there are multiple types of helices along the chain, right? And those can be broken up into 8 different categories over here, which is the tertiary structure, right? And then those give a curvature to the whole chain, right? And then these 3 different proteins will then come together at quaternary level to form this thing, which is called the tristelium. And then these tristeliums will all come together to form this giant superstructure over here, the 70 nanometer level, right? So going from angstrom level up to 70 nanometers or so. And this all happens essentially thermodynamically. It's all spontaneously driven once the thing is once the thing is actually synthesized. And so this is an example of a very complex assembly process, and it happens pretty robustly. And by robustly, I mean it has to happen regularly every time. It can't, you know, get stuck in some metastable state. It can't get stuck in some metastable state because you need this process to happen in order to live.
What did you see this thing was called?
Called? Clathrin. Clathrin cage. I don't think I put it on there somewhere. This is an electron microscope image of this, actually reconstruction of this. Actually, primitive? Yes.
Yeah. How primitive are these? How far do these go back, or how widely are these?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I don't know if they're constrained just to mammals. I mean, I think they're only in eukaryotic cells, so they're not in simple organisms like bacteria, for example. But I don't know, yeah, what point they diverge from the evolutionary line. That's a good question.
And is there a lot of variation in the tertiary structure consistent with them still forming?
Actually, I don't think the tertiary structure being these
yeah,
things over
the exact here. Details of the ordering the protein.
There's not a lot of variation there, in fact. Yeah. So if one of these goes in at the, you know, if one of these forms at the wrong place, then the whole structure doesn't form. So somehow it manages to fold regularly, some, you know, nearly 100% of the time. All right, so now getting to the physicist's point of view. Well, this is interesting, right? From the engineering point of view, it's really hard to do, right? But from the biological point of view, this is something that happens all the time. So why is it that we can't do it? Well, there must be some physical principles here that we're not understanding. So this is an infamous paper maybe by Phil Anderson from 1972. Which basically was one of the seminal papers in the whole idea of complex systems, just saying that, look, when you have, we may understand, for example, all the interactions between, say, amino acids, but that doesn't mean that we can necessarily predict what they will do in the end, right? So the idea, of course, that he encapsulated was more was different. Even if you understand what's happening at the pairwise level in such systems, it's not clear what's eventually going to happen or even what the equilibrium state is when you have many, many, many particles interacting simultaneously. In other words, it's a problem of statistical mechanics. And so from this point of view, right, you can think about that there must be some common physical principles underlying a lot of unsolved problems in condensed matter, right? So I talked about the biological problem. How do proteins fold, for example, is one question. How do these structures assemble? There may be some common physical principles between understanding this, right, and understanding how you might get things to self-assemble in the way you want them to do. In other words, if you solve this, you should be able to solve this as well. Right? And there are other problems too, such as understanding why glasses form and why other times crystals form, and even non-equilibrium processes like nucleation. So this is where we start, that there must be some physical principles that we don't understand yet. And I'll tell you a little bit about then the kinds of systems I look at. Right? The kinds of systems I look at are in a very narrow range of length scales. I look at systems. I'm an experimentalist. I look at systems that are, say, between 10 nanometers and, say, a few micrometers in diameter in a fluid. These systems are called colloidal particles. They are basically big aggregates of molecules, of polymers, of glass, what have you. They're macroscopic. They're classical. But they're small enough that they can actually sit around in solution for a long time, and thermal fluctuations drive them together within a reasonable time that we can observe. And the reason we play around with these is that, they're small enough that they can self-assemble, and I'll show you an example of that in a second, but they're large enough that you can actually see them. You can actually look at them under the microscope. And the reason is that the scale here is about the scale of the wavelength of visible light. And so these things interact strongly with visible light. And we can use all sorts of optical tools to look at them. What do colloids do then? So one of the interesting things colloids do is they can self-assemble. Colloidal suspension. Common colloidal suspensions are, things like milk. Milk is a colloidal suspension of fat droplets, paint, ink. These are all examples of colloidal suspension, small particles in a fluid. We deal with kinds of special colloidal suspensions where all the particles are exactly the same size. Well, not exactly the same size, but very close to being the same size. You can just cook them up in the lab. And if you take a suspension of particles that is all about the same size, and you densify it, it's sitting in a fluid, and you densify it, what you find is that if the particles are even if the particles are purely repulsive in this fluid, even if they are in the limit where they only interact as hard spheres, in other words, there's no attractive interaction at all, there's only a repulsive interaction and an infinite repulsive interaction at contact, basically billiard balls in a fluid. Even in this limit, what happens is, as you densify up to a volume fraction of about 50%, 50% of the volume is taken up by the spheres, it will spontaneously form a face-centered cubic crystalline phase. So there's a phase transition from a completely disordered phase to a crystal phase. And what's unusual about that in a hard sphere system? Well, what's weird about that is that there's no attractive interactions at all. Right? So what's causing the crystal to form? There's no energetic component at all. I heard somebody say it. Entropy, yeah. So the crystalline phase in this system actually has higher entropy than the fluid phase, which is a little bit counterintuitive because we think, well, you know, we always associate entropy with this idea of order. But this is a system in which that sort of rule is explicitly violated. In this case, the crystal actually has a higher entropy than the liquid, and part of the idea is that when you get up to a high enough density, if you organize these particles, each particle has more room to move around. There's more microstates associated with the fluctuations of each particle around their lattice site than there are in the liquid phase. And that's something that colloids actually taught us about condensed matter physics. This is an experimental system where you can actually get something that resembles a hard sphere potential. And when the experiment was done, you find that it does, in fact, form a crystal. And the reason that you know it forms a crystal is these things are on the wavelength of light. And when they crystallize, you can see these. This is like a vial, macroscopic vial. You can see these specks of color coming from it. Those specks of color are actually from the Bragg diffraction of visible light, or periodicity that's on the order of the wavelength of light. Do you have a question over there? Yes. Effectively, if you want to look at very long times, I mean, that repulsion that you're talking about is really the entropic repulsion. It's really the fact that it likes to sit and have room to explore space in. So I would say yes, in some extent. And what I'll explain later is actually you can control the interactions with these systems. So they can be hard sphere, but they can also have a longer range repulsion. And that's part of what makes them a nice toolkit for playing around with, you know, interesting ideas. Yes? So people do experiments like this. You can grab one of these guys, say, with an optical tweezer. You can just grab things and move it out and do experiments and look at how the fluctuations are constrained, right, when it's in the crystal versus outside, and even do things like actually visualize all the vibrational modes of the crystal and see how those change as you introduce defects and things like that. So, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I should be clear here. The way you go from here to here might be simply to take a centrifuge and take it down to this density. Okay. So in this case, yeah, that might be. Sorry, but I didn't make that clear. In this case, I've done is I've taken this and sort of put them in the bottom half of the container, and then they'll spontaneously flip over to the crystalline phase. Okay. That's correct. That's correct. So I could, you know, take out this part of the fluid here and observe this phase transition. That's right. Which drawing? Oh, yeah, yeah. Then you can take this whole thing and you can dry it. And then if you look at it under a microscope, you'll see the crystalline structure, right? So this is just to point out that this crystallization happens before the spheres are actually touching each other. So if you take a bunch of spheres and you pack them together as tightly as you can, you get about 74% space, volume fraction space that they fill. And it looks like a structure, something like this. Is there another question over here? That's 3D, yeah.
Okay. So colloids are interesting. They teach us things about condensed matter. You can see them. And they self-assemble. So they're a nice system for exploring some of this physics. The problem is that, you know, they're spheres, and so they don't, you might think they don't really do anything actually very interesting. From an engineering point of view, they're sort of a lame system, I think people have thought. And I spent my whole PhD thesis trying to get colloids to do interesting things. I showed you that they crystallize, but they don't crystallize into a whole bunch of different crystal structures, right? And from an engineering point of view, there's no way to control defect structure. The point group symmetry, which is the symmetry of the basis of the crystal, is sort of limited also. It's just a sphere. But I'm talking about colloids here, but I mean, the same ideas are true for many of the things that we try to make self-assemble, polymer systems, even fancy molecular systems. They don't self-assemble in interesting ways. It's very limited compared to what we see biologically. And the question we want to see here is, you know, why is that? Does it have something to do with the fact that we have these very, very simple things like spheres? So why can't we self-assemble? Why is there such a difference between what's done synthetically in these man-made systems and what happens in biology? Well, I want to turn this question around. I want to turn this question around and to say, well, really, what do we know about assembly in these, even in the simplest possible systems? And so we decided to do some experiments and say, well, let's look at the simplest non-trivial system you can think of, right? And see how it self-assembles. What is the simplest non-trivial system I can think of? Well, it's spherical particles. Spherical particles, hard spherical particles, let's say. What I would like to do, and this is to pose a challenge to sort of frame the talk, as an engineer, what I would like to do, I would say, well, wouldn't it be neat if I could take purely isotropic spherical particles in a fluid and coax them somehow to assemble into some crystal structure that I want, some structure that has all controlled defects, or, you know, to take this a step further, wouldn't it be nice if I could take spherical particles and assemble some arbitrary three-dimensional structure from them? Is this possible at all? Under what conditions does this happen? Right? So, but before you say it's impossible because the interactions are isotropic, we first have to look at what do isotropic particles actually do? So as I said, I want to look at the simplest possible self-assembling system. So let's say I have just a handful of hard spheres, not one hard sphere, not a million of them. Let's say 10. I give you 10 billiard balls. And I put them in a container. And then we'll introduce some attraction between them. So they'll stick, but they'll stick only at contact. And the question is, well, if I have this system, introduce these attractions, and it's limited to, say, 10 particles, what actually forms? I consider this to be the simplest possible system you can look at. Isotropic interactions, there's only an interaction at contact, and the hard sphere constraint introduces some constraints on, you know, keeps things from overlapping, essentially. So we decided to look at this problem in the context of self-assembly. We decided to look at this very, very simple problem, and the problem can be formally stated like this. What are all the equilibrium and metastable states of a system of n hard spheres with short-range attractions? And, you know, the motivation, as I said, is self-assembly, but there's also an interesting analogy to atomic clusters and some possible connections to other condensed matter problems, which were pointed out by David Nelson and Franz Papen, my colleagues. So how do you do this? Well, I'm an experimentalist, so we built an experiment to look at what happens when you have a finite number of spheres. Look at exactly what happens when you assemble them. So my postdoc, Guangnan Men, fabricated this plate, a microwell plate, which consists of lots of little pots that are 30 microns by 30 microns by 30 microns, right? And inside, we threw a bunch of these little particles. And you can make these on a microscope slide, and you can make it so that there are 10,000 of these little wells on there. So we did a brute force experiment. There are 10,000 wells on a slide. We throw in a bunch of these micron-scale colloidal particles, which behave a lot like hard spheres. And then we introduce an attraction between them, which we can control. And the way that we introduce an attraction is we put a lot of little small spheres here. So these big spheres are like a micron across. These small spheres are about 80 nanometers across. And what these small spheres do is The big spheres are here. Well, the small spheres are moving around a lot faster, and so there's an osmotic pressure on all of the big spheres, right? But when two of the big spheres come together, closer than one of these guys can fit, right, then that osmotic pressure is unbalanced, and there's a net attractive force pushing these guys together. You can control that force very precisely just by the concentration of these spheres here, and so we can engineer an attractive potential with a range that is much, much smaller than these guys. So essentially, it's like a sticking at contact with a controllable energy. And this time, in this case, the potential depth is well depth is about 4 times the thermal energy in the system, and we're about room temperature here. So he made this system. We throw a bunch of particles in there, and then we just, to see what happens, we just look at it. And you can actually see this under the microscope. So this is a movie of what this looks like under the microscope. This is a well. This is 6 spheres that have self-assembled underneath the microscope, and they form this little cluster here. And then the question is, well, what actually does form? So I will show you some movies. So if you have, say, 2 to 5 particles, what forms? Well, what forms is there's only one structure at every n number of particles. And it's pretty much what you would expect. If you have 2 particles, of course, they can only come together to form a doublet, just a short-range attraction between spheres. 3 particles forms a triangle. 4 particles, of course, forms a tetrahedron. And 5 particles comes and forms 2 tetrahedra that are put base-to-base, triangle, tri-pyramid. Pretty much what you would expect. The first interesting case, though, happens at 6 particles. And so at 6 particles, you get now 2 different structures. One of which you're all familiar with. It's an octahedron. Takes 6 spheres, and you arrange them in the most symmetric configuration possible. You get a structure like this. You can see it under the microscope here. The reason it's moving around is just Brownian motion. And this is a highly symmetric structure. It's a platonic solid. But we also observe another structure, which is this tri-tetrahedron solid. And this is where you basically take 3 tetrahedra and you put them all base to base. So 2 different structures that you can get at 6 particles. At 7 particles, you observe actually many more structures forming. In this case, 6 different structures. And in fact, you see some of these structures which are chiral, right? They break mirror symmetry. And that's this structure over here. And this structure, these are chiral pairs. Yes? I will go into that. I'll tell you about that. Yeah. But they're all, they're all at least locally stable. These are all room temperature. Yeah. That is a very good question. We'll get to that. All right. So this is a lot of structures. And then the question was, well, OK, what are we going to do? Just sit there looking at this stuff? Or are we going to try to figure out what is it that you expect to see? So I talked to my colleague, Michael Brenner, who's an applied mathematician. And we tried to formulate this problem and say, well, OK, is there a theoretical construction we can come up with? Is there some way we can formulate the problem theoretically and come up with an answer? What do we expect to see? So experimentally, I've shown you this system here. Theoretically, the problem from a statistical mechanics viewpoint is determine all the structures and internal energies of all the potential minima of the system for each n. And it turns out that that's actually a hard way to attack the problem because it's a very pathological potential. It's a hard sphere plus a very short-range interaction. So it's hard to do using the standard tools of statistical mechanics. But it actually translates very nicely into a geometrical problem, translates into a packing problem. And the packing problem is actually equivalent here, and it's to determine all the rigid packings of n spheres and the number of contacts in each. And the reason that works is because we only have an attraction at contact, right? And so the energy of our system is basically proportional to the number of pairs of spheres that are touching each other. And so there's a nice geometrical analog to this problem. So Michael's student, Natalie, was the one to make this connection and say, OK, well, this one might be hard, but what can we figure out about this one? And it seems like it should be doable for a system like this with 10 spheres. But problems like this have a long history in mathematics and physics, packing problems, some of which take, say, hundreds of years to solve. Kepler first conjectured 1600s of that face-centered cubic lattice was the densest packing of spheres in three dimensions. And it wasn't until 1998 that Hales finally provided a proof of that. That proof, I think he submitted it in 1998. The paper came out some 7 years later because it took that long to referee. It was a computer-aided proof where he exhaustively went through a lot of possibilities. And then I think at some point they had a panel of 30 mathematicians refereeing it. And at some point they gave up and said, OK, we think it's right. And so this is proof. Our problem is a finite sphere packing problem. There's also a long history of this. The kissing number problem, which is a famous problem from Isaac Newton and David Gregory, which was not proved until the 19th century. Our problem is actually related to an unsolved problem by Erdős, who formulated it in 1946 as the unit distance problem. And it still remains unsolved, and there's still like a bounty left by Erdős for whoever solves it. Even in the system, which ostensibly looks like it should be solvable, I mean, this is a hard problem with these sphere packing constraints. However, Michael's student Natalie was sort of undaunted by the fact that this was a problem that was unsolved by Erdős and all mathematicians that had gone past Erdős, and decided to attack it, and decided to try to get, she made it her goal to get an exact solution to this. But, you know, her tool was that she could do it computationally, right? So she could go through things computationally. It didn't all have to be purely analytic. So I'm going to explain a little bit about this theory, because it's kind of instructive about the self-assembly problem. So let me explain a little bit about this theory, and it's pretty straightforward. You start with an idea that all the attractions between spheres only happen at contact, right? So if I have a sphere packing, like the one I've shown here, I can describe the sphere packing by numbering the spheres, okay, and then making a matrix, which essentially describes the contact graph, what spheres are touching which. So in this case, sphere 1 is touching sphere 2, so I'll put a 1 in my matrix up here. Sphere 4 is not touching sphere 3, so I'll put a 0 over there. So every sphere packing can be represented by one of these adjacency matrices. The reverse is not true. Not every adjacency matrix corresponds to a sphere packing. Of course, you have to satisfy the non-overlapping constraint. So what Natalie did was just start with this basic idea and then just construct all possible adjacency matrix, the subset of which necessarily includes all of these things. Okay? But as you might imagine, there's a lot of those, right? There's like 2 to the n squared number of possible combinations here. So there must be some constraints on this. One of the constraints is that such matrices have to be non-isomorphic. In other words, we don't actually label our particles, right? So there are many different labeling permutations that correspond to the same matrix. So if you look at 10 particles or 10 elements and say, how many possible adjacency matrices are there? There's 2 to the n squared, which is 10 to the 13th. But there's only about 12 million of those that are invariant under labeling permutation. All right, so that's good. That helps out a little bit. But then there's also some constraints you can use because we're in three dimensions. And one of those constraints is that each particle has to touch at least 3 others to be fixed in space. Okay. So that narrows it down a little bit more. And then on top of that, there's a rigidity constraint, right? We're only going to be looking at rigid packings because we know that that's all that can form at equilibrium. And so there have to be a constraint on the total number of contacts, 3n minus 6, 3n because there's n particles, minus 6 because we don't care about the rotation or the translation. So we remove those degrees of freedom, and that's all you have left. And so that limits it to about 750,000, which is doable, right, computationally. But then, of course, how do you actually determine which ones of those actually correspond to packings? It ends up being solving these huge sets of quadratic equations. And this is where Natalie had an insight. You can actually do this analytically. You can solve sets of quadratic equations analytically and exactly and find all the possible solutions, but it takes a long time. And here's where Natalie had an insight. And her insight was as follows. She classified packings into 2 types. One of which could be formed by taking an existing packing at a smaller number of particles and then adding a particle onto it. So it formed a tetrahedron there. So this is what we called an iterative packing. And for iterative packings, the nice part is once you solve for the small one, you can easily solve for all the positions of the sphere in the next one. And you know it's a valid packing. Okay? All the distances are known. And the other type was a type that you could not do this for. And an example of that is the octahedron. There's no way you can break down the octahedron into rigid subunits. There's no way you can build it up of rigid subunits. If you take away one sphere, the remaining stuff just falls apart. And we call those new seeds. So going back to the numbers again, we're at 750,000 that we have to go through for 10 particles. Well, it turns out that the vast majority of these are actually matrices that can be constructed iteratively. Yes? Yeah, there's a, well, it's not more than six. It's a, there's more than, the Kissing number is 12, right? So you can't have more than 12, but that doesn't actually limit or constrain the system very much, as it turns out. It doesn't help you very much in terms of reducing the numbers. So for 10 particles, you have 750,352. About 750,226 of those are iterative, and you can go through these very quickly and solve for which ones are actually valid packings. And then there's only 126 which are not. And each one of these, Natalie went through geometrically, pencil and paper, and figured out which ones corresponded to analytically valid solutions to the problem. And from that came up with a list of what we believe are all possible sphere packings, finite sphere packings, up to 10 particles in three dimensions. And so this is the exhaustive list. Of course, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's all the structures I showed you before. There's only one possible structure. It's somewhat surprising nobody had ever proved that at even n equals 4, a tetrahedron is the only rigid structure that can form, even though it seems intuitively obvious. N equals 6, you get two structures. Those are the two structures I showed you. 7, you get 5, actually 6 if you count chirality. 8, you start getting more and more. And in fact, she went all the way up to 10. And this is the total number of packings, not counting chiral enantiomers. And one of the things you notice is that it starts to increase by a huge increase quite rapidly, exponentially, up to when you get 10 particles. And there's like hundreds now of possible ways you can arrange spheres. So 10 particles, there's something like 200, more than 200 ways you can put these together to get a structure that is different, which was somewhat surprising to us. What was even more surprising, though, was that all of these structures are degenerate. They all have the same number of contacts for any number of particles. So all 50 of these guys at n equals 9 have exactly the same number of contacts and exactly the same energy, which was much more surprising to us, which means that the ground state of the system is really highly degenerate. There's a lot of possible structures you can form. This is getting to your question of which ones are stable and which ones are not. In the ground state, they're all valid structures. It's a weird system.
It's a finding. It's not true for arbitrary level. I'll talk about that in a second.
Is the energy anything else than the number of contacts?
In this case, it's just the number of contacts, and we do that. Yeah, because it is so short range. All right, so we published this in the theoretical part of this in PRL last year with Natalie and Michael Brenner. And then we started looking at some of the what actually happens in the experiments. Okay? So all of these are degenerate. Let's go back to this n equals 6. Yes?
Sorry, you had an intriguing column, non-rigid packings.
We'll get to that. Thank you. So there's also a question about, well, what is the proportion of these things? So they occur in equal proportions. So at 6 particles, I showed you there's two different structures, this thing we call a polytetrahedron and this thing called an octahedron. And these are the two structures that you predict, and these are the two structures we see. They have the same energy, but in fact, this guy, the polytetrahedron, occurs about a factor of 20 times more often at equilibrium than the octahedron does. Right? So same energy, but one of them occurs much more at equilibrium. So what's the answer to why that happens? Entropy. Okay, but what entropy? All right. What entropy? All right, so why does this happen? Well, again, we went to the theory again. Entropy. So if you look at the partition function from statistical mechanics for a molecule or a set of particles, right? You can break that partition function down in the classical limit into three parts. There's a translational part, which corresponds to how it moves in space.
there's a vibrational part, which corresponds to fluctuations of order of the range of the interaction between particles. And there's this other thing over here called the rotational part. In the classical limit, this is how you calculate the vibrational part. You calculate all the normal modes of the system. And the normal modes are just harmonic vibrations of the whole structure. This is the lowest energy normal mode of an octahedron, for example. Okay. And for this other structure, it's here. This is the lowest energy normal mode here. And you go through and you calculate this. You measure the partition function, which tells you what the proportion of the particle should be. Your target is 5% of the octahedron. But in fact, what you find is that the vibrational entropy only contributes maybe a factor of 1.8, maybe a factor of 2. Doesn't explain our factor of 24. And another factor of 12 coming somewhere. Yes?
I was wondering why you find this explained in a way by saying that the bodies that are attracted to need only four things to come together at a time, and then we can add one particle and add one particle. But for the octahedron, we need six particles to be in their position.
Yes. So the explanation has, yeah, it has something to do with that. Right, and I will go through that. Yeah. So it's not vibrational entropy. So then it's this weird thing. There's this other form of entropy, this weird thing called rotational entropy. What is rotational entropy? If you look up in your statistical mechanics book, what is rotational entropy in the classical limit, you find that the rotational partition function is proportional to the square root of the moment of inertia. That makes sense, okay? That gives you sort of an average scale for the cluster, right? And if it's rotating around, right, the larger it is when it rotates around, the more the number of rotational microstates, right? So that kind of makes sense. But then there's this other thing down here, this thing called the symmetry number. So what is the symmetry number? So you can say how to calculate it. It's obtained by imagining all identical atoms to be labeled in a molecule and then counting the number of different but equivalent arrangements that can be arranged by rotating the molecules. And so in this case, if we did that, we'd find the symmetry number is 2 for this structure. The octahedron platonic solid has a symmetry number of 24. That's fine. You can go through and do that, and that would account for what we're looking at, but it doesn't really explain it very well. And the reason that, you know, you look up in a StatMech textbook and it says, well, why do you have to put the symmetry number in there? And it'll say something like, well, rotational states are quantum mechanically indistinguishable, right? So we can't overcount them. But I'm in a classical system, so technically everything in my system is distinguishable. All these particles are slightly different. So what is the analogy in the classical case? So I don't like that explanation, and so I will give you my explanation of what this means, and it's sort of like what you were just saying. Let's start with just the definition of what symmetry number means. So you have six labeled particles, we'll color them all with different colors, right? And I want to make one of these structures, and so I'll label the sites in this structure. And I want to go from here to here and start filling in sites. How many ways of doing that are there? Somebody can say the answer. Well, there's just, I can put the blue one in any one of the sites, and then that site is filled, and so I have to put the red one in five sites, and then so on and so on. So it's 6 factorial, right? 720 possibilities for each structure. Now, let's just, for a moment, go to the octahedron to explain the octahedron. 720 different permutations, right? Color permutations. But, of course, we know that by symmetry, some of these represent the same structure, right? So I pick two of these guys, and by rotational, you know, I can rotate one structure into the other. So in the experiment, these would be exactly the same structure. And because of the high rotational symmetry of the octahedron, there are, in fact, I put 720 of these guys on here, but there are, in fact, only 30 of them. Only 30 that are actually distinct from each other that I can't rotate into one another. For the polytetrahedron over here, the tritetrahedron, there's only one symmetry axis, right? There's only a factor of 2 there. I can only rotate one permutation into exactly one other. And so, in fact, there's only 360, or there's as many as 360 different permutations here as over here. Now, of course, in my experiment, I could choose to distinguish the particles, right? But in fact, I choose not to distinguish the particles. I choose not to color them. I choose not to distinguish them. And that's the key point. It's not the fact that they are indistinguishable. It's that I choose not to distinguish them in the macro state. And so essentially what I do is I put on my color blinders, and what I find is that The reason for the discrepancy is exactly what we said. There's only 30 paths you can go from here to here, but there's as many as 360 paths of going from here to here. And so what that says is that, essentially, that symmetry is unfavorable in these systems. At equilibrium, symmetry is unfavorable, and it's due to entropy. And if you go through with the calculation again and include that symmetry term, you now get a very good agreement between the experiment, which is the blue dots over there, and the theory, which is the red, lines over here. And the main contribution comes from the symmetry contribution. Symmetry is penalized at equilibrium. Yes. Yeah, it takes a while for them to assemble, like hours, but. You can actually see, and I think I have a movie somewhere, which I have a movie at the end, which I'll show you. You can see them flip back and forth between states, which is kind of cool. That happens on a slower, on a faster time scale.
Whereas the octahedral cannot build by starting with a stable one. It's not that explanation is actually logically connected to what gave.
As you formulated it, I don't think it is, because that's a kinetic argument, but we're really looking at an equilibrium system where bonds can break in addition to forming, right? And this is something that maybe I should just show this movie at the end. So I should make clear the system is at equilibrium. We wait for a really long time. And so you'll see things like this. This is an octahedron, right? And it's floating around, and then you'll see it sort of jiggle back and forth, and there it'll eventually form the other structure, right? So it switches back and forth, right? We let it sit for a long time so that everything's in equilibrium. So the way that in which it's formed, it's lost all memory of that. Okay. But there is an argument about how these things transfer back and forth. Okay. And so to go from an octahedron to this polytetrahedron, you can break any of 12 bonds. To go the reverse, I can only break one bond to do the reverse. That argument is exactly equivalent to the argument I made. That's an argument of detailed balance. All right. So what we have so far is that symmetry is penalized. Is it? It happens spontaneously. Presumably, the bond strength is about 4 times the thermal energy. So there's a finite probability that a bond could break during a reasonable time scale. And so then it just diffuses around, and then it finds the other state, gets caught in another energy well. We don't do anything, though, to force it to do that. OK. Going up, I'll just show you briefly results for 7 particles. 7 particles, we looked at all these structures too. My postdoc went and measured all the probabilities. We find again that you get very good agreement between the experiment and the theory. That's not so interesting as 8 particles. 8 particles is interesting because you get a wide distribution of structures with different symmetries. Structures that have very high symmetry, this structure has tetrahedral symmetry. These are different point group notations down here, Schoenfly symbols. Structures that have high symmetry, tetrahedral symmetry, this dihedral symmetry over here, you find don't occur very often. Low symmetry structures, chiral structures, asymmetric structures, things that don't have mirror symmetry, occur much more often over here. And again, you get a good agreement with the theory. Now, yeah. The blue line here is because there's a lot of structures that differ by a very, very small amount. You see these little gaps here? This is something you have in, if you have 7 spheres. You put 7 spheres together, there's no way to make them all touch each other. There's a little gap that emerges. And we can't actually see that little gap, but some of these structures differ in the location of that gap among the structure. But we can sort of measure the total sum of all of those in comparative theory. OK, so somebody asked me about what happens at higher numbers of spheres. Is this true for all n, that the structures are degenerate? So actually, interesting things happen at higher n. There's a structure that happens at 9 particles, which is what I would say is semi-rigid. Okay? So at 9 particles, you can get a sphere packing. And it's this structure over here. that is, you know, formally mathematically rigid, but it has a vibrational mode that can flex a lot. Okay, so it has one vibrational soft mode or floppy mode in it. And actually that leads to an interesting thing. As you go to 10 and 11 particles, you can start making packings that have more than 3n minus 6 contacts. You could actually start making things that are sort of redundant in their contacts. And so you actually break the degeneracy at some point, number of particles over here. And one really interesting thing about this is that many of these structures correspond to lattice structures, which is weird. You don't expect bulk order to emerge at such a low number of particles in this system. We don't understand this yet. It doesn't seem to be a rule that continues on for higher n. But what it allows you to do is to sort of map out what the ground state degeneracy of the system is. And you find that because of this, I mean, we saw these exponentially increasing number of packings over here. But if I just look at the ground state, it starts blowing up, but then it starts coming down again as you start getting these interesting special packings. And we saw some of these in the experiments, right? This is, it's hard to see this, this is the floppy structure here, this guy. And it occurs a significant amount of the time. These extra bond structures also, that didn't help. These extra bond structures, it is, but I've been told not to touch the lights because it messes with the filming, the videotaping. All of these occur at much higher probability than what you than the other clusters in the system. So they are they do seem to be stabilized. All right. So putting all of that together, putting everything together that we know about the system in terms of the structures of the packings and their free energies, their entropies and their energies, we came up with this plot, which basically gives you all the statistical mechanical information about this system. All right, so everything on here, these are each thing here, this is as the number of particles increases, each little symbol on here represents a packing for the system. And as far as we know, we've enumerated all the possible packings of spheres. And the size of this symbol, the number of spokes on it, indicates the symmetry number. Right? So the bigger thing up here, this is an octahedron, this is a highly symmetric structure over here. These are all symmetric structures. And then this gray line indicates, you know, how much free energy it has. So what you start to see happening, right, number of structures is clearly increasing as you go up with the number of particles. You also see that you start evolving a huge cluster of these states that are highly asymmetric, and these tend to dominate things, all right? You also see that this is plotted versus the symmetry, 1 over the symmetry number, essentially the rotational entropy over here, you see that things all follow this sort of curve, right? If I draw a curve over here, the highly symmetric structures are not as favorable as the low symmetry structures. But then you start seeing interesting things like these non-rigid states show up and these extra bond states show up over here. And these also seem to follow some curve. And so what I would like to do is sort of increase the number of particles in the system and see at what point do you actually see a bulk phase transition emerge in this system, which would be a neat thing to do because nobody's ever looked at a system where you can go from, say, 2 particles all the way up to infinity and see what happens. All right. Well, that is that. I have to get back to the self-assembly question. This is what we call the free energy landscape of the system. It's a solution to the whole statistical mechanical problem. It tells you everything that's happening in the system at equilibrium. But then the question becomes, how do I manipulate that landscape? If I'm an engineer and want to make things self-assemble, how do I manipulate that? What I've shown you so far is that you can assemble lots and lots and lots of different things, right? 10 spheres, there's hundreds of ways you can arrange 10 spheres to get things that are entirely different from one another. So spheres actually do a lot of interesting things, right? Even though they're completely isotropic, they form all these interesting non-isotropic structures. But then the question is, well, how do I get it to form, say, just one of those, right? How can I coax a system to form just one of these structures, right? In other words, informally, that question is, how do I change that free energy landscape so that it only forms one thing? And then how do I eventually get to, oh, I don't know, forming some arbitrary structure out of purely isotropic particles. All right, so I will outline perhaps a way to think about that. And it has to do with biology, actually. DNA, let me just take a detour for a second and tell you a little bit about DNA. DNA is a fascinating molecule. It's the most well-studied molecule in all of science. We understand the structure of DNA, of course, but we also understand the interactions between different base pairs on different DNA strands. And one of the things that DNA can do is that if you take two strands which have complementary base sequences, those two strands can bind to each other. And in fact, you can go and order DNA oligonucleotides, strands of DNA, with whatever sequence you want, up to, I don't know, hundreds of base pairs, and have it delivered to you the next day, and you'll have whatever DNA sequences in the lab. And you can design them with whatever binding energies you want simply by changing the sequence. You can do this all on the computer. We understand it well enough. So one thing you can do with DNA is also to engineer interactions between colloids. So if I have a colloid over here which is coded with a DNA strand over here and a colloid over here which is coded with a different DNA strand, I can engineer an attractive interaction between them by linking them together with a third DNA strand that hybridizes, that complements both of those. And if I do that in my system, if I take, say, two different particles, a colloid A and a particle B, okay, and A can bond to B, but it can't bond to A. I've removed the other attraction here. Everything here is due to the DNA. And I look through the system. What I see is that this is a similar experiment where I put particles in a microwell. What I see is that, let's see if we can freeze this. Okay. This is, again, this is a little bit too dark. There's actually two particles here and here. Okay. What you find is that these are particle A, okay, and these are particle B. And of course, it can't form in this state a tetrahedron, even though it's four particles. It can't form a tetrahedron because the binding rules have changed. A can only bond to A, B can only bond to B. Okay. So what this gives you is a way to control which particles bind to which. It gives you a way to control the contact network in the system. Why is that interesting? Well, according to this logic, let's pick a little bit different logic to be a little bit simpler. Let's say I have four particles over here, and they're just, again, things are isotropic, right? So I coat one of these particles with DNA strand A, one with B, one with C, and then one just randomly with all three of these strands, okay? And then I let A stick to A, right? What happens at equilibrium? At equilibrium, there's only one possible state. A can't bind to B, B can't bind to C. None of those interactions are allowed. The only interaction that's allowed is these guys can stick to this. This is the only structure that's allowed at equilibrium, which means that by splitting up this interaction between these many different kinds of interactions, A, B, and C, you can actually control which structures form at equilibrium. And Natalie, Michael's student, came up with a formalism for this, which is very simple. We start with another construct called the specificity matrix, which determines which particles can bind to which particles. So if particle A can bind to particle B, we put a 1 there. If not, we put a 0. And if this sounds familiar, it's because it is. What you can do is by setting that matrix equal to this adjacency matrix, which I said uniquely encodes for this packing, you can basically define which system, which state is the ground state of the system by having these multiple interactions. In other words, you can figure out a labeling scheme, all right, for a particular structure. And so in this case, I can code, this is an example of a labeling scheme for a system with seven spheres in it. This would be DNA strand A and D, which is randomly coded to the surface. This one has four of them on there, et cetera. Is there a question over here? Okay. All right. So that's interesting. It means you can basically label your ground state. And to see what happens in, say, a six-particle system, right, this is a labeling which will stabilize the octahedron, which, as we saw, was our metastable state in the case of purely the same interaction between particles. But once I split up that interaction, I can actually make a labeling which codes for this as a ground state and completely destabilize this. This cannot form. Its contact graph is not allowed at all. You can do vice versa as well. So I pick a different labeling and I can stabilize this packing over this packing. So in fact, you can choose whatever packing you want to make. And so we're doing this now. The trick is you have to get all the particles in the right place with the right colors, right, with the right labeling combinations. But because these are large enough, you can actually do this using different kinds of fluidic techniques. And so we have my student is now, Jesse is now working on, you know, doing this. He can now get, whoops, I don't know what happened to that. I thought that was a movie, but I guess it's not. He can now get, you know, six particles within the same well. And now the question is, can he get, you know, six particles of different types in there and see how they assemble? So that's where that stands right now as far as, you know, making different structures and picking a particular sphere packing, but what I want to show is actually what you can do with that in principle. What kinds of structures can you make? Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, so in biology, you know, DNA also codes for RNA, and RNA kind of does what we're talking about here. RNA forms and folds into structures that act a lot like proteins do, right? And the interactions there are kind of similar too. But it does seem that in biology, DNA is not used as a structural construct very much. I don't know the reason for that, the deeper reason for that, but it, you know, it's a good point. Is there a better way to do this than using DNA? It could be, yeah. It could be that it's more efficient to separate function between structure and protein being the structural component and DNA being the information carrying component. That may have conferred some advantage on the system. We think that in the early stages of life, it was RNA that coded for everything, both structural and information. That's the theory now. And at some point, DNA evolved. Yeah. Okay. So what can you actually do with this? These are toys. Have you guys seen these toys, Geomags? They're pretty common, fun toys you can play with. They're just balls, stainless steel balls, and magnets. I have lots of these in my office. Michael has lots of these in my office. We order thousands of dollars of them and play around with them a lot. The interesting thing about Geomags is that, you know, all these rods are the same size, okay? And there's no constrained bond angle. There's no you can rotate them all around the sphere. Everything's isotropic. It's not like a chemistry set. And so, in fact, everything that you make with Geomags that is a rigid structure actually represents some rigid sphere packing. Because all the bonds are the same length, which means all the spheres are the same size. Yes? Yeah. Yes. Yes, no, definitely. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities to what you can get. And so there's a big question of how do you actually choose what labels. You actually have some freedom in what labels you choose. And so there's actually a question of what set of labels should I choose to eliminate all of those metastable states and only get the state that I want. So that's a good question. So the Geomags, I forgot to bring these. I forgot to put them in my suitcase. Otherwise, you could play around with them. But Geomags, anything you make with Geomags that is rigid represents a rigid sphere packing in three dimensions. Okay? And so, actually, the question of what structures can you make by spheres has, in some sense, been solved by everybody who plays around with Geomags. There's a huge community of people who play around with Geomags. They make structures like this. We can make all the structures I showed you can make with Geomags. In fact, in some ways, what we did in that PRL paper was to construct all the things you can make with Geomags, right? All the rigid structures you can make with Geomags. But there's also all sorts of other structures you can make. And there's a museum in Paris, for example, that includes structures like Big Ben, which is made entirely of Geomags. And so the argument is Big Ben can be made with Geomags. It is rigid. Therefore, it can be represented as a three-dimensional rigid sphere packing. Therefore, there's an adjacency matrix which describes the structure of Big Ben. Therefore, there's a specificity matrix that encodes for that same adjacency matrix. And therefore, there is some set of labels that uniquely encodes for Big Ben as the equilibrium state of a set of isotropic spherical particles. there is a way, in fact, to make spheres form Big Ben. The question is, well, how are you eventually going to do it? And that's what we're working on now. I want to show Natalie, just to show you what a code looks like for one of these systems. This is not Big Ben. This is some other structure she made. She made this out of Geomags. It's some cylindrical structure. It corresponds to some virus structure, I think, actually. So then she figured out a labeling scheme. And this is essentially the computer code, in some ways, that codes for this structure. This is what you would have to, the number of each label you would have to put on each particle. So the number of labels actually scales approximately with the number of particles, and so you can you have some flexibility there too. And there's multiple codes that correspond to the same structure. So the questions now are, well, okay, that's interesting, but you can actually do more than just define equilibrium state. You might also be able to arbitrarily change the stability of metastable states also by choosing the proper labeling. And of course, now the challenge is actually building that, which is what we do in my lab. I want to conclude, though, just by saying, OK, well, we start with these spherical particles, right? And spheres are kind of, don't seem so interesting. But actually, what I think we found is that they form all sorts of interesting structures, many more structures than we ever expected. And the thermodynamics are straightforward. In retrospect, they're straightforward, right? You can understand, which ones form, and you can enumerate the possibilities for the system. And we find some general rules about what forms at equilibrium in the absence of these specific interactions. So we know that, for example, with this octahedron, we know that we're going to have to design some particular way to make that the equilibrium state, because it doesn't occur naturally due to the rotational entropy. But the bigger point here is that, systems that are isotropic can still break symmetry in a huge number of ways, right? In fact, I wouldn't say essentially arbitrary ways, but a rather large number of ways they could probably do whatever you want it to do. And the design rule seems to be that you need more than one interaction, more than one orthogonal interaction acting at the same time. And this is something that, in fact, you can only really do, to the best of my knowledge, at this length scale, at a scale that is much larger than the atomic scale. The atomic scale and below, you're limited with whatever nature gives you in terms of quantum mechanics. But above that, right, where interactions are averaged over groups of atoms, you can design all sorts of average interactions. And that's what DNA itself does. It defines an average kind of interaction. And so at these scales, you can actually get interactions which are not possible in atomic systems. And maybe this kind of design idea of having multiple specific mutually exclusive interactions is something that evolved also over time in natural systems as well. So I will stop there and thank everybody involved. Natalie is now at Rockefeller University. Guangnan is my postdoc. Jesse is my student. Michael Brenner is my colleague, my collaborator on this. This was all funded by NSF and also a little bit by Harvard. So let me thank all of these people. And thank all of you, and thank you guys for inviting me and for hosting me. Thank you.
Questions. We have questions from students.
I was wondering if there's any kind of analogy between this type of hacking and how the wave functions assemble in nuclei.
Yeah, there's some way you can explain a lot of this geometrically. There's this whole valence pair electron repulsion theory, which basically looks at what are the sphere packings you can get if you just assume repulsion between orbitals, and what are the sorts of wave functions you can get from that. Yeah, so there is some analogy. Of course, in this case, it's a purely classical system, so it's a much easier one to treat.
Any more questions from the students? Okay, then open to questions generally.
So I guess I'd just like to ask you to comment anything that comes to your mind with respect to two quick points. One is that nature seems to build whatever it builds with a number of labels that's much, much smaller than the number of particles. The second observation is that from what I know of protein folding, kinetics are very important there, and you've been looking at equilibrium.
Okay, first question. Yeah, it's really interesting that there's 20 amino acids that basically form everything. And, there must be, I'm sure that this is what we're looking at now, there must be some information theory approach to understanding some of this, and what's the minimum number of labels or things that you need in order to build what you want to build. So that's, first of all, I think that's a good question. I don't know anything. Second question was about kinetics. So when I was talking about this, I blew by this very quickly. I'm talking about this energy landscape. Yeah, this is a sort of thermodynamic construct, okay? But in a sense, all of these minima in this landscape represent metastable states. And so if you can get rid of all of those minima, then the system can only have one choice in terms of its. You can have multiple kinetic pathways, but they all end in the same place, okay? There is some evidence, that's one issue of addressing kinetics. In protein folding in viruses, as I understand it, there is some evidence also that certain transition states are stabilized. So there are bonds that are in a transition state in a protein, two parts of the protein that are touching each other, that don't happen in the ground state. And that might be also another interesting strategy to look at here in terms of controlling which path the system takes to equilibrium. Can we force it through a particular stabilized path? And that's a whole other direction.
Yeah. And so this is a kind of taking Robin's question in a particular direction. In the fantasy of nanoscience and self-assembly in nanoscience, there are two questions which have always puzzled me. So one of them is it imagined that this self-construction, you know, if you imagine growing a house or growing a chip, okay, that this construction will take place in equilibrium or far from equilibrium. And related to that, this sort of a time scale problem. I mean, biology is wonderful, but it actually takes biology a long time to grow something that's macroscopic. And it might be that nanoscience works but is impractical because of how long it takes to actually self-assemble things.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with that. All the practical challenges, I mean, this may ultimately never be a useful way for making materials. It may be useful for certain things, for certain practical things. It may ultimately never be useful. From my point of view, it's worth looking at just because there's this big difference between what we can do and what biological systems do. Now, but let me say something about like what strategy you might use. There's something else that biology does, right? I was talking about equilibrium here. And at a small scale, I would say biology makes equilibrium structures, proteins fold into what we think are equilibrium structures, and these clathrin cages are what we think are equilibrium structures. But at larger scales, it's driven. It's driven by chemical gradients that are forced by energy coming into the system. It's driven by electric fields even, right? It's driven by all sorts of things. So in terms of what that means as a lesson for people doing nanoscience, you probably want to use assembly at the smallest scale where thermal fluctuations are important, and then move on to something that's more driven at larger scales with external fields. And I think that may get you past the kinetics problem as well, using the driving forces.
Mm-hmm. Just clarifying something. When you showed the picture of all the structures up to 10 spheres, were you only counting the structures with the least energy? That's a maximum number of contacts?
Yeah, well, it was counting on the structures that were rich,
right,
and therefore represented energy minimum. So any non-rigid structure could,
So a sphere, a sort of buckyball, would fit into that?
A buckyball would represent, a rigid packing. Buckyball by itself actually has a... This is the buckyball over here. This is, as itself, is not rigid unless you stabilize these pentagonal spaces over here. But if you put that on there, yes, it corresponds to rigid packing. And so all these shell structures, like a buckyball, which is in fact also a primitive virus structure, we know from our analysis would actually be the highest free energy structures because of the high symmetry. The icosahedral symmetry is the highest symmetry you can have. So these would be...
So those are not included. Those are not included in your classification.
Well, they are. They're rigid. This, if you made this rigid, it is included in the classification. I am looking for this. These high symmetry structures here that have the highest free energy, one of the things we found about them is that they're all an interesting class of structures. They're called deltahedra, convex deltahedra, which are the most symmetric structures you can make out of regular triangles. They are all, in a sense, related to icosahedra and other shell structures, like the buckyball. So some of them are included, but we didn't go up to high enough number, right, to see actual buckyballs or dodecahedra, et cetera.
Is there any possibility of forming, rigid bonds between these polar particles? Like if you have many, many of those DNA bonds, then would the bond be...
Flexible?
I mean, not flexible, rigid.
Oh, rigid, so it could stick together. Yes, it can be done. There are enzymes which will go in and clamp that down and make a covalent bond between the two spheres, so they're basically absolutely stuck together with no rotational degree of freedom.
And it's, then you can make monkey balls and whatever you want.
You could, yeah, in doing that, you may be able to stabilize certain non-structures that are non-rigid, like the buckyball, for example.
Sorry, question here.
I wonder whether this kind of system could be used to study Stuart Kaufman's idea of autocatalytic networks. So you have a large number of sort of different labelings, mm-hmm. and then certain labelings can connect, others can't. If the number of links reaches a certain threshold, then you'd expect that all of them can now link together into one set. So you just throw a large number of differently labeled things, and you find this transition point where all of a sudden everything will stick together.
Right, some percolation theory, but within a limit of multiple interactions.
If the number of links compared to the total number of vertices becomes mm-hmm. large enough, then it'll form one connected network.
So I'm not familiar with the idea. I think I understand what you're saying, but yes, I mean, and I think that's an interesting experiment to do because I think it actually may be straightforward to do an experiment like that and see what happens. So.
Just an application of lots of people have spent lots of time making photonic systems, and the lens scales you have are exactly the lens scales people look at.
So
three-dimensional photonic systems are practically impossible with silicon. And you're ready for that. You can do them with fluoride and this stuff.
So in some sense, this is how this all started. My PhD took 7.5 years, and I was trying to make photonic crystals through colloidal self-assembly. It was just like, well, you can't really control anything. Well, what can you really do with colloidal self-assembly? So then I decided the more interesting problem is to say, well, what's up with self-assembly rather than what's up with photonic crystals?
So you could make a wave.
Now you can imagine coding for any structure, any crystal structure with defect structures, anything. Yeah. So that's maybe one way to go.
That's